I've been playing a lot of Halo. I played some Halo with Connor and Peter last night.
We got to get on Halo together because I got that Xbox too.
What's your gamer tag? I'll fucking add you right now.
Yeah, I know. I definitely added you. I added you and JPC.
Oh, well, I'll go home right after this and play some fucking Halo.
Let's play Halo right now. Why are we even doing our jobs? Speaking of
your
which,
job,
hey, hold on. This is two people's only job in this room right now.
I have one other job that's also a podcast. Right now. My wife gets paid a consulting fee.
Who?
My wife.
Thank you.
We rent Johnny from
Jessica.
When we left Travis last, you know, you just kind of were in Oromar's kind of spiritual mind palace, getting a little bit of a pep talk from Dref on how to do what it is you need to do to control this body and move. You, like, kind of awakened to find yourself tied down with vines. And I think one of the weird things, like, you opened Oromar's eyes and you vaguely have an understanding kind of how you would activate those eyes and use them the way a person would perceive with their eyes. But right now what you are doing, like, it's a little faint. You are looking through the open eyes, almost like a spiritual window where you can see out of the spiritual world into the physical. It's a lot hazier to do things this way, but, like, you don't have to go through the process of, you know, activating the eyes to actually look through them. Everything is, like, really complicated, but, like, what you see is, like, looking around you, you are kind of bound to a wall with the vines that have overgrown this body.
I mean, so first thing I want to do is look around and see if I'm alone or perceive if I'm alone.
Yeah. So this is interesting. To do this, are you going to just, like, spiritually kind of look around, or are you going to try and activate the eyes and head to move them so that you can look around?
I think I want to try and move my current head.
Okay. Okay. I need you to make a, gosh, I guess this is a divine check.
And this, would this be Oromar's divine or Travis's?
Yeah, this is interesting.
I mean,
this is an interesting concept because we get to, like, what is a person, you know?
This body is equipped to do it, so maybe it makes it easier. But
but is it the body that's doing it, or the whatever is in the body?
Say that again, Johnny.
Is it the body that's doing it, or is it? I think that the body is used to doing it. Here's what I propose, and feel free to not accept this. I think I roll with Travis's divine, but I get a blue because the body is used to doing it.
Interesting. Interesting. What is Travis's divine skill? Has he put anything into it?
I have two greens.
Two greens? Okay, so that means you haven't put any skill into it whatsoever.
And then Oromar's is two greens and a yellow.
Okay. I kind of think we'd be using Oromar's stat, because it's his physical body and your skills. So I think it would be, the end of the day, three greens for you.
Okay.
Three greens, and I'm gonna say this is an average check, and that is kind of accounting for the fact that you said earlier that the body is kind of used to doing this.
Mm-hmm. That is one success and two advantages.
All right.
One nice. Success, two advantages. Okay. Like, two things happen. You activate the eyes, and you have the sort of disorienting experience that Orimar has, where you are seeing things physically, like you enter a physical space, but also kind of at the same time perceive things spiritually. And the first thing that you notice is that what you are perceiving is different. Like, that's your advantage, is that, like, you the success is you are able to move the head, you're able to, like, activate the visual centers of this brain and move as you need, but your advantages are you had this kind of distinct look as you were looking through the spiritual windows that are the eyes of what the outside world looks like, and it is different now. When you look around, you can see yourself. It's as though you are, like, tied down almost in, like a prison type setting. It's odd. It appears to be made out of, like, bits and patches of, like, indistinct memories. Like you can see as you are looking physically through the eyes, like, things that look familiar to you. And the body that you're in keeps fading in and out, whether it is Orimar's body or your body. But in the spiritual view, you see Orimar's body. It is physical and resolute, and you see vines crisscrossing around you, and they have these vibrant purple blooms coming off them, these beautiful flowers.
But I am... There's no one else here with me, correct?
There's no one else there that, like, you can see immediately. Like, you are on a wall. There is, like, this line of, like, trees in front of you, but you're not high enough to see over them. But you can tell that you're also, like, kind of off the ground.
Okay. I want to try and get loose from the vines.
All right. You have, or, like... This is physical, so I think this would be entirely done with Orimar's stats. So how do you want to do that?
Can I reach the sword? Or is that... Am I too, like, strung up?
You are restricted right now. Okay. But the one thing I know about Orimar is he's extremely strong. So you might be able to move. It would be... I think it would be a hard check to grab your sword. If you wanted to just sort of, like, Hulk-style bust out of the vines, it would be like a daunting check, but I think, like, just trying to struggle to move your arm to the sword, I think, is just hard.
Then I'll do that. I'll try and get the sword. So would this be just like a...
I feel like athletics.
Okay. That is three advantages.
Okay. So you don't manage to succeed at the thing that you were trying to do, but something advantageous happens anyway.
Gosh.
I think you pull, like you activate the arm and you pull against the vines, and, like, they start straining and snapping kind of immediately, and you reach across your body towards the sword that's at your hip. But the momentum of that, I think, carries you forward to where your torso, like, rips free of the vines, and you are, like, hanging down now out of those vines. But it is, like, sort of a ragdoll thing. The muscles that are activated are your arm muscles, and they are not they're not the rest of your body. So, like, your torso is hanging limp. So you've got this free arm as you sort of flop forward out of these vines.
How far am I from the ground?
Looking down now, you can see that in both instances, in, like, this sort of prison, this vague prison that you feel that you're in, and the field of vines and flowers, you are, like, maybe 3 feet off the ground from, like, your feet above the ground sort of thing.
Now that my arms are free, can I try and just, like, Hulk my legs out? Like, use my arms to rip the vines off my legs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
It's still going to be a hard athletics roll, but like, yeah, you're taking a different approach to roll. So
that is one success and one threat.
Okay. I think part of this is like, we cut back to like a mansion view as you are like trying to do several things, because this is not the ease with which a spirit would normally move a body. You are trying to like pull levers and things, and like these spiritual strings that you're pulling on are more sensitive and less sensitive at times than you think they will be. You grab the roots extremely hard and you pull, and at first it's not enough, and then you pull again and it's way too hard. They rip off, the body falls, and there's just an impact where the nerves of the body are trying to like contact the brain. Normally, Orimar does not feel pain that his body would normally experience, because like it's not useful. If you were to turn on pain sensation for Orimar, like there are a bunch of things that are like out of place and have been put together temporarily. If the body were to actually sort out those sensations, there would be no way that it could interpret it but pain. So instead, it just makes sense to like, well, I will not feel these things, because why would I indulge that pain when I simply don't have to? When you engage with certain parts of the body, you are not aware of how to disengage from that initially. So you just get a shock of pain that like gives you a strain, first of all, and you have to like pull back from it really quickly. And like as you do, like the vision of like this vague prison setup pulls away, and like you just see this odd camera angle of your eyes being open very close against these vines, because you've kind of flopped face forward onto the ground.
Can I try and stand?
I think so. I am going to call for one more divine check, and this is going to be, I'm going to make it hard, but if you succeed at this, it will be kind of like the general non-specialized coordination roles that you need for the remainder of the scene.
Okay. That is three successes and two threats.
Wow.
What I think this means, you will, for the remainder of the scene, anything that is like normal coordination is just going to be successful. We're not going to have to roll for it. To do actions that are specialized, like combat actions or whatever, it will take two strain from you every time to focus on it.
Okay.
That seems fair?
Fair enough.
Cool, cool. All right. So describe like how Travis makes Orimar stand up. What does that process look like?
I think he spends a few minutes sort of on the ground. And very slowly, I think, now that he's not, like, stuck to a wall, he's very slowly sort of, like, pulling at the marionette strings, kind of, and, like, making, you know, kind of pulling one, seeing what moves, like, maybe seeing a finger twitch, like, pulling another one, like, okay, that's the pointer finger, maybe this one does the pointer finger on the other hand, but then it accidentally, like, lifts the whole arm up, you know, just, like, yeah. I think it takes a bit to sort of like make a mental map of the whatever like pulleys and crazy stuff is going on, but eventually is able to stand up. And I think that the way it looks when he moves is a combination of like almost like the Frankenstein's monster, like just like really stiff. But then I think eventually, as he gets more used to it and sort of is mapping the way that Travis normally moves onto this body, I think it almost looks more like the way that Chris Kattan moves in the film Monkey Bone.
Oh, great. Yeah. Hmm. Great pull, Johnny.
You're going to have to be more specific
what we
than me.
Would love. I remember watching Monkey Bone as a child and thinking, man, I hope someday I produce a piece of art that evokes this film.
Oh,
it's just very like, It's not at all stiff, but there's still not a lot of control over the body. Mm-hmm. So a lot
I think
of
that
like,
is like
very ragdoll
description. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Like monkey bone is like just unfortunately exactly the perfect description of what's happening here.
Yeah. Oh, so it's definitely like not a lot of control or precision, but less of that Frankenstein's monster. And I think because Travis has that sort of like swimmy laziness about moving.
Yeah, that's true. Man, this means that in a live action version of this, the actors that play Travis and Oromar must be dancers. Mm. And they will not only have to at one point physically embody the way the other moves, but whoever's Oromar will need to be so good at fine muscle control, like robot style dancing, to pull this off, which excites me a great deal. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it is a very, like, it's both comic and eerie the way that it unfolds. But the end of the day, Travis stands up in Oromar's body. And it hits a point where you're like, hey, I think I got the hang of this.
Now I want to see if there is any way that it seems like I could know. First, what I want to do is I want to try and talk. First, I want to try and whisper, because I don't exactly know what the deal is, so I don't want to just call out for anyone, but I also want to understand how to talk so that if I need to, I can. So, yeah, I just want to try and say, like, you know, is this thing on or something like that.
This is a daunting check. It's moving fingers and limbs and whatnot, getting the spine to balance itself. Like, you can see whatever it takes to make the body balance itself is a automatic and complicated, like, web of magic that has both marks of Dref and Oromar's handiwork on it. And the levers that the strings that you're pulling to make the rest of the body move are, like, kind of big and obvious. And then there is this tangled mass that is the vocal cords. It is wild. They can move in so many different ways. And it's not just the vocal cords. It's also the tongue, the mouth, your jaw itself, your cheeks, your lips. There's so much involved in this. So this is absolutely daunting.
That's four purple?
But mm-hmm. That's four purple.
Against my three green?
Against your three green.
I think I can do it.
That's Travis Madigo, baby.
Wow. Oh, that's a complete wash.
So, a thing that you find out almost immediately is this clearly needs something beyond your own control to operate. Even if you understood how the movements worked, nothing would occur. And then you remember the sloshing sound that came out of Oromar the first time that he actually spoke after having died.
Oh, this is
because we hit a wash.
Yes.
I had to draw a loop.
Oh, yeah.
You motherfucker. Ha! There's absolutely
yes.
no way.
I just did it. You were in the room with me.
I don't know, man. At this point, I think
the wettest card in the deck.
drippy.
It was the changeling. I don't think
it was the
said
changeling.
It
mm-hmm. I was here. You could have seen.
I was looking at the.
Yeah, I would like to change the dry to wet, please.
Yeah. I'm trying to tell what that means in this circumstance.
Oh, I have an idea.
Uh huh.
Is there wet in the stomach of the captain at this moment?
Hard to determine.
Okay. Because if there was previously ingested wet inside, I would like to try and get the wet up and back.
Logically, yes. The scene that happened before we all got moved elsewhere was Oromar visiting the family Kessler, to which he needed to be able to speak to do that properly. You have been upside down for a while, and peristalsis is probably not something that you have control over. So a lot of that has probably fallen out of you.
Fair enough.
I think, rather than looking for how wet interacts with
we're
barf.
Still saying wet.
We're still saying wet. Mm-hmm. I think, like, what I'm going to rule, the yearning, impulse, and will, the last word that Orimar said aloud before this change happened is what comes out in this moment. And I think Travis will be able to notice exactly, like, how damaging this could be just because, like, things are dry right now. Mm-hmm. I think we'll take another strain as you say this word, and we'll ask Nathan what the word is in a second. Mm-hmm. But the body will pull from Travis spiritually to repair necromantically the damage that is caused by saying this word. Nathan, what word are you going to give Travis?
Said more hoarsely than probably what my voice box will currently allow. You get a farewell.
I feel like it comes out almost sounding like when you scrape your fork or a knife on the plate, where it's like you don't mean to go that far into, you know, you're like trying to cut something, you don't mean to go that far, and that's just sort of what happens.
Yeah,
you get a bunch of like pain data as well. Not that it means anything to you, but it sure did something.
So I take a mental note. I'm like, okay, I'm going to put a pin in that one until I can find some wet. Now I want to try and find a way out.
So wandering forward, like you push through this small grove of trees and you find a clearing. And I want you to make a perception check. It will be of average difficulty.
Okay. Ooh, not bad. Okay. That is two threats.
Okay.
I perceive nothing.
Okay. No, it's weirder than that. Mm-hmm. I think the vision, like Orimar's vision, reconnects itself to yours and starts to overwhelm what you see purely spiritually. You're in this prison cell. You walk forward to what you know is a grove of trees. And it's like almost like magic eye painting style. It's like hard to make your mind stick to this image. So you reach forward and try to keep a line that, like, yeah, spiritually I'm moving aside vines, but like in my vision, I'm opening a door. You open the door and, you know, in the prison, it is night. It is like cold. You can, you know, you're not breathing, but like you would be able to see breath. There is maybe some moonlight that is coming in through the window. When you open the door, it is bright daylight. And there is like a strong summer's day. You can see light filtering down through leaves in this beautiful glade that is chillingly familiar to you. You look around and you see an Illimat table. You see a collection of blooming white flowers that you know to be heartroot. You see a throne, a magnificent throne, that you know belongs to your mother. And she is seated upon it.
Well, I can't talk, so I guess I will do a little, just a jaunty hat tip.
Travis knows hand sign, I think.
Yeah. Travis would know hand sign. Kind of been around 200 years. I think we decided it's just something that he would have picked up at some point.
No, I'm still going to do the hat tip.
Yeah. And you... It's funny. The queen speaks. She moves her mouth. And you realize you aren't hearing because you have not activated Orimar's ears to hear.
May I?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can, as you do, like, you come in the middle of the speech. You look strange, my son.
I'll just sign... It's a long story, but I'd gladly tell you over a drink.
And with that, some flowers start to like come together and twist like in sort of a climbing pattern the way vines might climb a fence or a tree, except they are wrapping around one another and they bloom out into a small tabletop, and they twist again into the form of like these just giant like flowers blossom up, and they're like tight flowers that are in the shape of a cup, and you can see like water and nectar are poured into them from the bottom, so they're just like these two like flower bloom glasses in front of you. And she gestures,
"Have a seat. I imagine you and I have much to talk about."
I'll take one of the cups and take a seat.
Hey heroes, it's James, your game master, and welcome to the mid-roll! Heroes Campaign Skyjacks is about to migrate over to our new host, Megaphone. Now hopefully you shouldn't have to do anything in response to that. We are redirecting our old feed to the new feed, so no matter what you use to listen to the show, it should transfer smoothly. However, in case something does happen, you may need to delete your feed and resubscribe. That also means we're going to have dynamic ads on our programs. And yesterday I posted a bonus episode explaining how the dynamic ads will work and what to do if you hear an ad that you don't think should be on our show. It's only 6 minutes long. Be sure to listen to it. If you have any questions at all, I believe they'll be answered there. Before we get back to the show, I want to send out a hearty thank you to all of our backers on Patreon. We've got one backer who we've missed. Thank you so much, Nim, for supporting the show. We should have a new batch of backer thank yous coming up soon, so if you want to hear your name on the show, head over to patreon.com/oneshotpodcast and sign up to support us. Signing up at the $5 level or more gets you access to cool audio bonus content. That includes the character creation sessions for Douglas Kessler and Zana Kessler, which went up in November. It also includes a brand new Patreon-exclusive campaign, Starwall, which is kind of a space fantasy game. And the reason I bring it up here is to play that game, we are playtesting the role-playing system that I hope will one day become the official Skyjacks RPG. If you want to see the ideas that I'm playing with to develop that system, Starwall is the best place. And it's a super fun game. It stars me, Mel, Drew Merzieski, and Allie Grauer, who y'all might recognize from Skyjacks Courier's Call, as we play residents of a tenement that was secretly a spaceship who get lost in a very weird and vaporwavy version of space. I think if you like this show, you'll like that show as well. Now then, with all of that out of the way, let's get back in the sky!
Now, we cut over to the crew of the Uhuru. Everyone was partying last night and partying hard to celebrate our dear friend, Jonnet Kessler. And, you know, the sort of Sweet 16 celebration that they throw in Acheron, it's the kind of party where you just sort of pass out where you are. And everyone's pretty chill. Maybe somebody walked around with blankets while a few folks were cleaning up the immediate things that need to get cleaned up. But we have a group of people waking up near each other. I'm going to ask you all who you are playing.
Oh, yeah, we discussed this.
Who of your various crew characters you're playing?
Oh, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, Jerry.
I believe I am playing Pliff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Soup boy.
That is a nickname that Pliff unfortunately has to have.
The fabulous furnaceer Carlos.
And Mr. Barry.
Whoa!
He's back.
All right, Bathroom Barry, back from Lightfellow Ranch after the vacation, got back in time for the party and managed still to party enough to pass out where he lay. What happens? Whatever furniture that you were on, and I think I will be Nodos for these scenes. Whatever furniture that you were on that you laid down to rest on is here. Whether, you know, it's like a table or a bench or a pile of hay, it's here. And they're all kind of collected around one another. The equipment that you have, everybody has at least a knife or like a, you know, a small knife-like implement. Because the rule that Gable created unknowingly at the beginning of the Acheron arc is we're not taking weapons to dinner, but knives are acceptable at dinner. Mm-hmm. So to be ready for anything, people have knives, but your regular weapons are presumably back on the ship, wherever the ship may be.
I'll say Barry did not carry a knife. He just has a very sharp fountain pen because the pen is mightier than the sword, and he's an artiste.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Especially in the hands of Barry.
Carlos, considering prior to their job as a furnaceer, was a brewer, so probably has a couple of bottles of moonshine grog that they've previously made, and a lighter. I guess it's a rope lighter, because we don't have like a fuel lighters in setting.
Yeah, I'm almost afraid to ask. Johnny, what does Jerkoff Jerry have?
A condition.
At least, and probably pants with pockets cut out.
Yeah, I want to say, okay, he's got a bowl, but the bowl does have a hole in it. But so it's like, you know, the thing where you go to the movie and you stick your dick through the hole in the popcorn. So much, but
common thing that everybody does.
He's not doing that
for real.
To get other people to touch his dick. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He has that so that he can snack and touch his own dick easily.
Oh, that's a fun invention. That's kind of a fun invention.
That recolors any meal that we've ever had with.
Again, it's just for Jerkoff Jerry. Yeah. This is just his personal bowl.
And I think if you are eating with him, that's kind of, you know what's going on.
You know not to serve him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's all he has.
Nodos definitely, as Gable gave the order, like, has a knife, and everything else was like, he's out here for a good time. Mm-hmm.
I think Barry also has like a, it's like a brand new composition notebook. Like he's ready and open to new ideas, being struck with inspiration. And so he has like a new notebook that he's like tied to like a satchel and has it like slung over his side.
Mm-hmm.
Cliff, over the course of the night, ended up babysitting like 12 people's drinks. They would hand it to him. Can you hold this for me, please? I just need to go get something. Mm-hmm. And so over the course of the night, he just sat at a table that got more and more drinks that got abandoned by people. But he didn't sip any one of them because alcohol makes him... It's not that his tummy hurts. It's that his he's afraid of his stomach hurting. So he just avoids alcohol entirely, except for the times where he accidentally drinks it because he thinks it's a refreshing water. And then he gets accidentally drunk, and that happens a lot. So he wakes up surrounded by empty glasses, and he feels so badly because he was supposed to protect all of these drinks over the course of the night, and all the drinks are gone. So now he just has a bunch of skeins and loose glassware that he has, and also no coat, no shoes, because he did fall asleep first.
Of course, that is a tradition on the Uhuru as well. Looking around, you can see that you are just in a thick area of forest. The ground beneath is littered with sticks and small plants, not enough to make the forest bed green itself, but the light that filters down through the leaves is quite green. It is warm. It is a summer day. And you have no idea, any of you, where you are.
Well, that party was one to remember. Hold on.
What has happened?
Did we happen to party a little more energetically than any of us agreed upon?
I feel hazy. I feel like I need to warm up my vocal cords again.
Well, you're not in theater at the moment, darling, so you can go at your own pace.
Jane?
Oh, no, my bowl doesn't have a hole in it anymore. Oh, nope, there it is.
I don't want to investigate that. As much as I do want to investigate that further, I know I
it's
don't.
Probably I'll give you one guess what it's for.
Investigating where Jane went, though. Has anybody seen her?
No, I'll go find her. I'll go find Jane.
No, Pliff, you shouldn't.
Pliff just gets up and starts walking around. Jane!
Nodos, like, hurries after Pliff. We must stay together.
Jane, they've taken my shoes. And typically my shoes are found at the top of the crow's nest. But they knew that I knew that that's where they were. So they've been putting my shoes other places, Jane. Jane, I need my... I don't have socks either. It's going to get so wet and musty between my toes, Jane.
Please stop. For the sake of all of our headaches.
Once we find Jane, it'll all be all right. So I need to find her. Jane!
This is not right. I remember sleep taking me in the heart of Acheron.
And there definitely aren't any forests like that near there.
Perhaps. Yes, perhaps. Maybe a mile away? I do remember trees when we landed. But we rode the carts away from the ship.
Let me ask you something. Do you think that maybe it's possible that I'm just dreaming? And none of this is real?
Carlos goes over and with immaculately manicured to those kind of like sharp point nails, kind of jabs you in the shoulder.
What'd you do that for?
Barry walks over, and with his very finely sharpened pen, he jabs Jerkoff Jerry in the other arm.
Okay, now it just seems malicious.
Well, if you felt that, I'd assume
to prove a point.
You're not dreaming, then, if that hurt.
If I have found myself transported to a fantasy within the mind of Jerkoff Jerry, I feel as if I shall lay down and pass away exponentially so as to avoid any further exploration into his psyche.
That is a shared sentiment between us both.
Yeah, I guess you're right. If this was a dream, things would be going a lot differently right now.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
I think we simultaneously all of us start calling for Jane.
You know, Jane! If you jerk off in a dream, you jerk off in real life.
For the love of God, Jane,
stop
no,
it!
For the last stop time, it. You're the only one that applies to.
No,
all right?
it's called a nocturnal emission, and it happens to the best of us.
You have a condition,
emission.
You have a condition.
Emission.
I often wake up wet, but other people have thrown things upon me. of a wet nature, and that I just imagine that it is like
Carlos's expression actually has a moment of genuine consternation.
Pliff, I didn't realize other members of the crew treated you that way. That's honestly unacceptable.
Oh, I don't think it's purposeful. I just happen to be inconvenient and annoying.
He is tripped on frequently. It just happens.
It is not malice so much as the world is malicious to the idea of my existence. Jane!
Okay, as I see it, we have two options. We can either move together as a group, trying to reclaim parts of the crew, or we divide forces, decide upon a point where we will meet and move in an arcing direction to meet at that point so that we can sweep through the forest.
We don't seem to have any kind of real understanding of where we are. The idea of splitting up seems like adding more complications.
Yes. Although speaking of working out where we are,
you kind of mentioned that the kind of like light is like dappled through the trees and making it green. I think Carlos looks at one of the taller ones and
give me a second
and starts to climb it.
All right. So now we are getting into rolling. Mm. This is different. So we do have rules for rolling, and they are based on the crew at full strength. The crew at full strength starts out with 2 green dice and 1 yellow die. However, we're just our group. So right now, as our group, we get 1 green die to everything that we do. However, you can commit your character to the roll that you are making to upgrade the dice that you are rolling with. So what this does is increase the threatened range of your Uhuru Death Chart roll. So if you fail, each failure counts as 1 D100 roll on the Uhuru Death Chart. Mm. Right now, the normal threatened range for the Uhuru Death Chart is up to 31, and those are for listed out crew members that we have. You take it to 40 when you commit yourself to one level. You can commit yourself to multiple levels to increase your die rolls. So, for instance, it would become 1 yellow dice if you commit yourself to 2 levels. You know what? I'm actually looking at this. I'm going to say instead of starting with 1 green die, I'm going to have a start with 1 yellow die. I think that makes more sense.
We are competent, even if we're not in number.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So that it goes 1 green, 1 yellow.
1 yellow, 1 green, 2 yellow, so on and so forth.
Yeah, exactly, and so on and so forth. So like, you can commit yourself to multiple levels, but that means any failures that you experience will be threatening you quite a bit, like this character quite a bit. And, you know, I think it's been a while since anybody's seen the Uhuru Death Chart. You have no idea how many hit points you have. But for a lot of characters, it's not many.
Carlos is relatively new. Yeah, the odds of death are quite high.
So how much do you want to commit yourself to this, Nathan?
Yeah, let's commit to this. I think the idea of climbing a tree is not inherently so full of daring do that we need to heavily push ourselves. However, in the discussion that we had previously, I don't think it will be on air by the time that this is on air. I know, in a meta sense, that this could go very, very wrong. So I won't push it, but we'll still do the action anyway.
So how many levels was that again? I'm sorry.
Not pushing it, just rolling the single yellow.
Okay.
Against how many?
I'm going to make it 2 purple.
Sure. Carlos turns to the tree and tries to climb above the canopy line to see what it can see. That's just 3 threats.
Okay.
Failure with 3 threats, I guess.
3 threats, but for success failure, we draw a luminary. Mm-hmm. I'm fanning the cards out, Liz. You can see this is going to be...
Watch his hands. Mm. Watch his hands.
The Forest Queen, that makes sense. Mm. The Forest Queen makes perfect sense, and we'll establish the rules.
I just don't like it here. This place, in this mind state, not enjoying myself.
Yeah, this is horrifying. Dominance, nature, expectation, and order. I think what it is, Nathan, you can decide whether you succeed or whether you fail. What becomes clear to you, almost instinctually, if you reach the top of this tree, you will have to make a sacrifice or make a promise of some kind. Mm. If you fail, we're going to be rolling on the Uhuru Death Chart. It will just be 1 roll.
Okay. I think you know, one does not enter into the Forest Queen's domain and then come back unchanged. And in building this space, we decided that part of the rules of this space is that you cannot get above the tree line. Just don't. Breaks the rules.
Yeah.
Which is why I tried to do so. Because I am a drama gremlin. Carlos climbs the tree. And I think this tree happens to be like full of like pollen-laden blossoms. And it like fills the air the higher you go. Like the density of this pollen gets thicker and thicker as you climb. To the point where Carlos breathes in and then can't proceed any further. Something just stops them from ascending any higher after taking that breath full of pollen-laden air and then has to descend.
I like that. I like that a lot. I will roll on the Uhuru death chart now. 53?
Out of range.
Out of range. Just barely. Let's see. And had you committed, it still would have been out of range. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Barry is kind of like looks a little confused at Carlos. Did you get cold feet on the way up there? What's going on?
Something is wrong with the air. Maybe.
Something is wrong with Carlos. No. And he jots that down. Something is wrong. Something is doing a little notation underneath it.
I breathe. It's hard to explain. But upon reaching almost to the canopy, I took a breath. And then something changed. And I just had to come back down. I was against the rules.
Oh, I do stuff that's against the rules all the time.
All right, then you go. You go then up there.
By all means, climb that tree.
Climb the tree.
All right. Jerry climbs the tree with his ample upper body strength.
Yeesh.
Yikes. One arm notably stronger than the other, unless you're ambidextrous, I guess.
Yeesh.
Johnny, making this roll, are you committing anything to it?
No. I'm just going to go for it.
Okay. So you're rolling one yellow die.
And what's the difficulty?
The difficulty is, again, this is hard.
I think I can do it. That is two threats and a triumph.
Oh my God.
What?
Hey,
so that nets out, unless the success that was provided by the triumph is canceled out, that should be one success too, or did you make that calculation?
Because
a triumph counts as both a success and a triumph.
I am doing what the app told me, which is...
Oh, okay. So the app did the calculation. Yes. Okay. So that means we draw yet another card. I fan them out in front of Liz. Liz, would you like to pick a card?
I'd love you, but I can't. I can see them with you.
The maiden.
She's here.
Hold on. The three cards that we pulled in our forest arc were in sequence: the changeling, the forest queen, and the maiden.
No. Cursed.
That's good.
Just
good stuff.
I want to be here.
Okay.
Practicing close up magic.
No, I wish I had.
Okay.
I would love to do card tricks.
All right.
Oh, I have no talents.
I want to do card tricks.
Yeah, I'm going to say that exactly like Pliff. Well, the maiden means kindness. So I think ultimately... This means it's like kindness, mercy, and generosity, I believe. This is like a positive result for Jerry. You said the other was a threat?
Two threats.
A threat and two threats and a triumph. Jerry, in climbing this tree, I don't think you are going to get above the canopy.
Okay.
As Carlos stated, and as is established, it is against the rules of the Forest Queen. However, you will have, through the triumph, through the success and the triumph, and through the will of the maiden, there is something that is going to allow you to know where the ship is. And the thing that I need to know from you, Johnny, is what is that? Is there like some magical compass that is on Jerry's body? Is there something about the bowl that he has? Did you just see something through the branches that's far enough away? Because this will be a fixed point that you will somehow be able to navigate to. It has something to do with the fact that you climbed above the trees, and it might have something to do with the fact of like facts that we don't know yet and just discovered in this moment.
Something that is compelling to me is the idea that Jerry does have some sort of compass or something magical that points him back to the ship, because I like the idea that he, while he does jerk off most of the time, also be a valuable member of the crew.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that whatever it is was something he chose to do to himself, and not because he was like, I care about this crew, I want to help, and not a Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer situation where he had some ability that the crew decided to exploit.
Okay, mm-hmm. Here's what I like. A thing that I think we established in the world building episodes, like I it was either between myself, Drew, Aaron Catano Saez, and Jeff Stormer, or one of the world building sessions that we just had together for one of our places, is the quote unquote retirement system that exists amongst Corsairs, where as you cross certain parallels and thresholds in your service aboard a vessel, and like this isn't just Corsairs, like it's mostly Corsairs, but like other Skyjacks have it too, you get a piercing or, you know, something embedded in your flesh that theoretically like is always a part of you if you're caught or captured or whatnot, but that could be extracted and worth money. So like, you know, at the end of a piracy career, you're full of like earrings and or like beneath the skin, like subdermal piercings and whatnot that you can like have cut out. And it's like, this is like a couple hundred gold bars worth of material that you could sell and live your retirement. So
that I like that. And something that has always been compelling to me in the real world that I've heard of not many people doing, but I've heard of people doing, is implanting like a small magnet as like a body modification, usually in like your finger. So maybe it's something where like ships have a certain, each ship has a specific like material.
There's the heart bell.
In the heart, like, but the unique to their heart bell when it's like forged that interacts with, you know, people who choose to get this sort of payment or whatever will get an implant that reacts specifically with whatever is in the heart bell.
Is it?
This is so cool. Well, one thing that we do have through the document that I've written up on jousting recently is sympathetic bindings. And you know, if you're a fan of like the Name of the Wind series by our good friend Patrick Rothfuss, it's a little bit similar to that, but different in like there's energy and attraction being transferred through objects of like make. So whatever, I think it is the tongue of the heart bell, the thing that rattles around and makes the sound, that is made of a very specific composite and alloy of metals. So with your subdermal piercing, like it's almost like a ring with a single ball bearing inside. And that ball bearing is made of the same metal composite, the same very specific metal composite of the tongue of the Uhuru's heart bell. So like in, you know, you can decide, Johnny, where it is, but you can like feel in your skin that ball kind of like roll around and like stick in the direction of the Uhuru.
That's very cool. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe it's like, oh, I kind of like the idea that it's on the back of his hand. So that, like, if you make, like, he can feel it, so he doesn't really need to look at it. But if you kind of make a fist, you could see the bearing, like, move under his hand so he could show other people.
God, that's so weird and creepy and cool. I love it. I love it.
And if you ring the bell hard and fast, it does make your hand go back and forth really, really fast, which I think is really useful for him.
Okay.
I mean, well, is it...
There it is.
Can it go in the opposite direction? Can you, like, make the tongue move by making...
Yeah, every time... you can tell...
Because then the crew would know when...
Mm-hmm. It's
Jerry. Jerry.
Sorry.
Tone it down.
That's great and terrible. Well, I love everything about it.
You would.
You get a certain elevation into the tree where you can feel the bearing in your hand move, and. You know, holding your hand out flat, like kind of looking at it, but like you can also just sort of instinctually feel it. You know the direction that the Uhuru is.
Oh, I have one small addition.
Please.
It's on the back of his hand, but I think he also has a tattoo on the back of his hand that lines up with this. So, you know how, like, under a compass, you know, you would, like, line up a compass? It's like that, so he can kind of turn and line it up. So then, like, if he falls under the tree line so that he can't pick up the you know, magnetism or whatever, the bearing is still aligned with the tattoo in his hand, so he could still tell which direction you should sort of go.
That's really, really cool. Well, I think kind of what this must mean is you have the bearing, but also in this same implant, which is like extremely mechanically complicated. And I don't even want to think about the real life logistics of this as a thing. I feel like there's also a natural compass.
Yeah.
You know, like a magnetic compass that you're able to use. So it's like you can see the bearing of the compass and you know which degrees it is versus like the Uhuru's direction, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Maybe there are like just two bearings and one is the compass and one is the heart bell.
Yeah.
And they're like concentric rings.
Yeah, on separate tracks underneath you. Mm.
God, it's cool. God, that's so cool. And I love everything about it. Oh my God.
It's a great thing to put on a bed. Person.
Yes. To make a bad person suddenly inexpendable.
Yeah.
Oh, so I also cool. I do think it would be funny if he has this and no one knew, and then he's just like, "Well, no one asked."
Every time I talk about my hands, people look away.
I'm a rich tapestry of a man.
A handful of people would have to know if it's specifically tuned to the Uhuru's heart bell. So whenever you got that put in,
that's
at
true.
Minimum, somebody would probably know. But it might be a limited number.
I think it's like just the captain.
Who doesn't.
Spit would absolutely know. Like, this is within Spit's purview. This is like an extreme loyalist move that you would make for the Uhuru. And, you know, there's already the feeling that Jerkoff Jerry is like kind of in Spit's camp. You know, as we imagine, like, Nodos and Gable kind of like, and Wendell kind of having this block of like the beefy brave boys of the Uhuru, there is like the old perverts who are real Captain Orimar loyalists.
It's sensual.
Great.
Yeah. But you shoot that azimuth. You get the direction that the Uhuru is going. So you have a point at which you are oriented towards. And the malicious things that could have happened to you in this moment, you are spared, in part, thanks to the maiden's kindness smiling upon you.
Well, I know what direction the ship is, but you are right. It is not allowed to go above the tree line.
It's an unusual feeling to be forced to play by other people's rules. I thought the life of a corsair was specifically getting around that sort of thing.
No, I'll tell you, there are all kinds of places where you're not allowed to do certain things.
Yeah.
And I learned that the hard way and the difficult way.
Like gravity and thermodynamics.
They ignore you.
Like gravity and thermodynamics, I suppose there are some rules that just can't really be broken. But
let's not jump to any conclusions. I think we should stay right here so that if anyone has left and are expecting us to stay right here, we're their stalwart soldiers and it'll all be fine. Just need to stick around and wait for them to come back.
So you want us to stay here in the forest that is not ours?
Well, I think obviously our friends left, and if we're not here when they come back, well, they won't be able to find us again. So that's just the safest thing, I think.
Wouldn't it make more sense for everyone to make their way towards the ship?
Yes. If you find the ship, at the very least, we'll be able to, you know, ring the heart bell or do something that would be able to get people's
attention.
Perhaps
even pull the ship into the air.
See, she wouldn't have left me, so she must be away and was expecting me to stay in one place. So she wouldn't have gone, so I can't go away from here because she's not here.
Pliff, all right, you're trying to say that Jane somehow planned your separation?
She always knows what to do, so.
Okay, well, sometimes Jane doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't have all the answers either.
We're just talking silly now. We're just saying words.
Is this really how you operate on a daily basis? You think Jane just knows all things?
Well, why wouldn't she?
Because she's here on just her left and right feet on planet Sphere like all of us.
She's like a human being, man.
With a limited scope of knowledge and experience.
But he said, she said.
Carlos goes over to kind of Pliff and puts a hand around his shoulder. And there is like something like a perfume coming off them. And then you kind of notice that there's still lots of flecks of pollen across their body. And that seems to be what's emanating this scent. But it is, if nothing else, soothing, very soothing. And in your ear.
Now, Pliff, you don't need to be all stressed. I don't think Jane would like to see you stressed. You do have all of us alongside. Let's just move together as one unit.
Jerry moves over to Pliff's other ear. Yeah, I mean, if you're stressed, I can think of a way that you could maybe Pliff's relax and calm down a bit.
It's so close. It's like I feel the lip skin inside of
just cochlea. Just let me know if you want me to tell you what it is.
I know exactly what it is.
Yeah. Jerry probably reeks of pollen perfume as well, actually. It's a lot. It's like, you know, if a lush store attacked you directly.
As far as the ability to navigate the forest goes, we may very well be the only group that is capable. I know Spit has been in the sky a long time. There is a possibility that he has a similar retirement implant to Jerry here. But the captain, of course... The birds, if they are out, they could also be around. There's a chance that Gable, if any group has the ability to reach the ship, we could, you know, either raise the ship, free the birds. There are things that could be done. Because we have that ability, we must take it.
I agree.
Yeah, I think I think Nodos is just talking specifically to Pliff.
How about this, Pliff? The four of us will go, and you can stay here all alone. Get some private time.
Yeah, jot down your thoughts. He offers Pliff his composition notebook and pen. Just by yourself, your own musings. Does that sound good?
We'll see you later, Pliff.
Pliff hasn't had a thought to himself in a long time and has not turned inward very frequently. And that idea of being alone with his own thoughts is so frightening. He runs out in front of everyone else and then just holds a hand out behind him and says, Jane always holds my hand. Who's gonna?
I'll hold your hand.
A big swallow.
I'm not going to speak on that. I was going to save you from that, but no, this is better.
Pliff, I think as your hand closes around Jerkoff Jerry's, you can feel the implant a little bit as your fingers wrap around.
I'll tell you why, his hands are smooth, though.
Gotta be. A lot of lotion, you know?
Uh-huh.
So we open with a shot of the kitchen aboard the Uhuru. We can see potato skins, like, kind of piled up. We can hear, you know, a peeler working. And it is this slow shot that is moving up the heavily muscular body of Slam in, you know, his tight little apron. It moves up and then, like, sort of like flashes around different parts of his body. It's like his hands working. It's the little chef hat on top of his head. But then finally you're confronted with a shot of his face, and he's got the worst facial hair imaginable right now. It's like the most teenage proto mustache that you can picture in your head. It's horrible. It's patchy and nightmarish.
Orma comes in to the kitchen and is like, hello, lads. I hope dinner preparations are going smoothly.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, Slam, as always, your potato peeling is so smooth. And eyes follow from potatoes up to Slam's face. But it baffles me. It really perplexes me, mate, that your beard, your chin, can't have that kind of smoothness as your excellently peeled potatoes.
What do you mean?
Well, look, for example, and Orimar runs a zombie finger. It's sanitized, I guess. We have hand sanitizer in this PSA, and just kind of like runs it over the surface of the potato, and additional Foley is put in where it's just this kind of smooth sound. And then on the other hand, and he rubs it down the side,
and
we get a delicately like placed slightly on the cheek. Almost sensual, and then the finger drags and it just sounds like iron being dragged across a concrete
floor. Yeah. Like, it is one of those things where we can see each individual hair being pressed down and then flicking up, and it sounds like shattering glass and screeching iron. It is just the most miserable thing. Shot like a horror movie.
I think Toku leans out from, like, back in the kitchen. I told you, don't touch your beard. Can't stand that sound.
Sorry. It's my problem. Slam, mate, I feel that you are a big boy now, and it's time to share a little bit of dad knowledge with you.
I'm getting hair in different places than it was before.
And that's normal,
Oromar turns to the camera. Do understand that Slam is actually in his mid-30s and is very much an adult, and this is not weird.
It's the supplements. It's the supplements that I take.
There we go. That explains the additional hair. Yeah. And in the other places, it's more... I mean, I love a hairy chest, mate. Can't really maintain mine these days, but love it on other people. But that bit.
It's my hairy shoulders, though.
I like the idea that Slam is growing hair in new places, and it's weird.
The palms of my hands.
Oh, you got hairy palms too?
You are definitely not allowed in the kitchen.
No. It's okay. I got hair nets on my hands.
No. Jerk off, Jerry is absolutely not food safe. Look, yeah, the hairy palms that we're definitely going to need to shave. Fortunately, I, as a resident teacher on Uhuru, teaching these orphans how to do their life skills, am in a position to go and teach you how to shave. And waves a hand, and just in the kind of like, this flag means death, like slightly flowery font, still in the electric pink, shave kind of appears.
Oh, wow. Adult grooming techniques. Yeah, sure.
One of the orphans bounces up with a little silver tray of various razors. These have been freshly sharpened and polished just for your perusal, Captain.
Captain, there are so many different implements. How do I know which one is right for me?
Well, what you need to do first is that you go and take one and feel it in the palm of your hand. Feel the weight. Feel the aerodynamics of the shaving implement.
Feel the rhythm. Feel the rhyme. It's shaving Indeed. Time.
There's like, upon picking up like one of these shavers, like a little bit of a backbeat kind of comes in. We pick up a different one, and this one sounds like a maraca for some reason. Mm-hmm.
We're waiting for that steel drum, that Jamaican bobsled vibe that we're going for.
Yeah, now you're feeling it, Slam. Now you've got the rhythm with your shaving. Thank you very much, Timmy. You're dismissed.
And then Bobby runs up, and he has a tray, and it's filled with all kinds. There's a various bowls with creams. There's somehow an aerosol shaving cream can. We have plenty of cream applications for you, Captain. Whichever you're liking.
Marvelous. Now, the important thing when choosing a shaving foam isn't the lathering.
Don't eat it.
Also that, you don't eat okay. it. Although, to be honest, you could probably eat the can entirely, Slam, and it wouldn't kill you.
I was going to say, these all look delicious. I'm glad that there are snacks involved in shaving.
Well, what was going to build into my point is that you don't eat it, but the most important thing is not the feel of the lather or how much it lathers in your face. It is about the fragrance.
Oh.
Now, close your eyes, Slam. Let the wafting aromas of these shaving foams fill your nose. What do you smell?
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Bobby takes one, and he holds it up to his face, and he does a very delicate blow, and we can see the scent travel from the shaving cream into Slam's nostrils.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think like we enter Slam's mind palace. And
do we get to see Slam's soul? What color is the little orb?
Yes. I mean, well, like Slam's soul is very, very much
it's
a baby blue. Yeah. Mm. It's got
monster energy baby blue though. Mm-hmm. It's like this little bit.
And we can see it's sort of like the Matrix where we just see the world like rush in around Slam.
I'm on a beach. The sun is out. And my body is covered in a tanning oil. And an aroma it wafts across the waves and the sand, and I feel at peace.
And we see in the distance, like, the ship of the Mariner slowly start to approach from, like, off camera. And then Oromar's, like, bony hand comes into shot and, like, wipes the... Let's not dwell on that for too long.
The darkness encroaches, Captain.
Yeah, it seems that we have very little time until we need to hit battle stations, so we need to rush through the rest of this shaving process really quickly. All right. Right, who has the implements for the third step of shaving? Anybody? We're on a bit of a time pressure here.
The aftershave? It's not prepared. The technology, we only have it in beta testing. Are you sure, Captain?
God damn it, we're going to have to do it.
Okay. Oh, fellas, come on. Like ten little boys and little girls just come in and bring in a tray full of the most potent, small, very like powerful green tonic.
Yeah, that Carlos, I think, like comes into the room. This is Carlos's latest invention.
Yes, this is my latest invention. I feel that the process of actually using a razor is a little too slow. So what I thought might be a good idea is that we just burn the hair off your face. But it has a minty fresh smell.
Captain, is that recommended?
Shit, I don't know. And just kind of like picks this thing up, pulls a pin in it like it's a grenade, and just hurls it at Slam.
And we get like a magical girl transformation sequence. It's like fire kind of envelops Slam's body, and where once there was like hair on his shoulders and palms and face, like this like cleansing fire moves over it, and his body is like slick and shiny and somehow freshly oiled on top of that. Shing, cling. His apron is like caught dramatically in the wind, and he just goes, "I have the power." Yeah.
And you too could have a body as well sculpted and fresh like this if you subscribe to my package, Carloscaped. For just 3 bits a month, we send a box of incredibly potent elixirs straight to your door.
And we cut one over, and it's a Gable talking to another bunch of orphans. And that is how we avoid getting subscribed to subscription boxes. All right.
And yes. Thank you, Gable.
All right. That's how it happens. That's exactly how it happens. And remember, don't let this happen again.
That's right.
Excellent.
Don't eat the shaving cream.
But also,
that's right.
We have to. Every PSA ends with "Don't ever let this happen again."
Campaign Skyjacks is a One-Shot Network production. For more information, be sure to follow us on Twitter over at CampaignPod for updates about live shows and other events we might be doing.
Welcome to Character Creation Cast, a show where we create and discuss characters, the best part of role-playing games, with guests using their favorite systems. I'm one of your hosts, Ryan Bolter.
And I'm your other host, Amelia Antrim. Join us as we sit down with game designers, podcasters, and fans of games as we dive into learning about different RPGs through the lens of character creation. It's a combination of character building, player advice, game design insights, and even a little bit of fan fiction for a different game every month. We tackle a variety of new and old games, both well-known and indie-produced titles.
We learn how creating characters can tell us a lot about the games themselves. Check us out today anywhere you can get podcasts or on the One Shot Podcast Network at oneshotpodcast.com.
You can find more great gaming shows over at oneshotpodcast.com. Jonnet Kessler was played by Tyler Davis, who can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Tyler A. Dave. You can stream his short film, Lining, on the Roku channel for free. Just search for The Shortlist, Summer. Gable was played by Liz Anderson, who can be found on Twitter at @LizAnderson_... or on her podcast, Paired. Travis Madigo was played by Johnny O'Mara, who can be found on Twitter at @JohnnyNBriefs or on his podcasts, Bill Buds and Dilettante Ball. Captain Oromar Vale was played by Nathan Blades, who can be found on Twitter at @PhantomArtsENT. You can also find them streaming on twitch.tv/TheNeonCaster. I am James D'Amato, your host and game master. You can find me on Twitter at OneShotRPG or on my other podcast, OneShot. The original music featured in this podcast was written, composed, and performed by Arnie Parrott. You can find him on Twitter over at @ArnePArrott. You can find more of his work at atptunes.com. This episode was edited by Casey Tony, who can be found on Twitter at @CaseyPony or on his podcast, NeoScum. Our logo was designed by Fiona Shea, who can be found on Twitter at @FionaPup. The World of Sphere was inspired in part by the music of the Decemberists, and Illimat, produced by Together Studios. This show uses a modified version of the Genesis role-playing system, designed by Sam Stewart and a team of talented professionals who were fired by the private equity firm owning Fantasy Flight Games.
And once for our friends ne'er to rise, twice to the dearest we're leaving behind, who know we can never deny the call of the skies.